This is Phil Cousineau, Joseph Campbell and the Art of Pilgrimage. This was a lecture in October 2006.
So to introduce our speaker tonight, Phil Cousineau. Phil is a writer, teacher, editor, independent scholar, documentary filmmaker, travel leader, and storyteller. His lifelong fascination with the art, literature, and history of culture has taken him on many journeys around the world. He lectures frequently on a wide range of topics, from mythology, film, and writing, to beauty, travel, sports, and creativity. He's here tonight because of his connection with Joseph Campbell and with Pilgrimage. He co-wrote the award-winning documentary film, The Hero's Journey, The World of Joseph Campbell, and edited its best-selling companion book. And he's published 18 other books, including The Art of Pilgrimage, A Seeker's Guide to Making Travel Sacred, and Once and Future Myths, The Power of Ancient Stories in Modern Times. I've enjoyed Phil's books for many years, and I particularly enjoy his sense of the mythic in everyday life, his mythopoetic images of places and people met in his far-flung travels, travels that I would love to have taken with him, and his talent for soulful travel. Whether he's writing about the Baseball Home of Fame, Hall of Fame, Paris, or Angkor Wat in Cambodia, he always follows psyche's meandering path to a deeper understanding of the genius loci, the spirit of place. In The Art of Pilgrimage, Phil wrote of a journey to Angkor Wat in Cambodia. It was in memory of his father, who had inspired his trip but never made it himself. And it inspired me to think about how many of us make pilgrimages not only for ourselves, but for others who are left at home or who never got to make the journey. I think that accounts for a lot of us. Reviewer Gail Hudson wrote about The Art of Pilgrimage, "Most compelling is Cousineau's ability to expertly map the interior landscape of a pilgrimage, the sites that lead to insights and the borders that lead to breakthroughs as we trek the exterior landscape of our planet." So we'll go on a pilgrimage tonight with Phil Cousineau. Please welcome Phil Cousineau.
Thank you, Shirley. Can everybody hear me without too much of a feedback here? Let me know with thumbs up or down as we go. Thank you for mentioning the book and my father. As soon as I checked into my hotel, I looked across the street and I saw the Space Needle, which all of you are used to, but for me is a mythic image because I grew up in Detroit. My father worked for Ford Motor Company all his adult life. And besides being a folklorist of Ford Motor, Henry Ford in Detroit, he was also their representative to the World's Fairs all around the world. So he was here in 1962, heading up the Ford Pavilion at the fair. And once a week, we would get these crackling phone calls from all the way across the country from Seattle. "Phil, have you done your homework?" Which I haven't thought of for 44 years or so. So it's very sweet to be back here in a city which my father came to love. Some of you know the debt I have to him for my love of myth and ultimately my connection with Joe Campbell. And for those of you who don't, I grew up, I imagine, one of the last homes in America that actually turned the television off on Saturday night so that we could all read out loud together. It was a family ritual every Saturday night. My dad turned off, I think it was Gunsmoke. And some Saturdays it was the Detroit Tigers baseball game. And he would wag his finger and say, "Philip, someday you'll thank me for this. I swear." That was the line he used. And as a family, we read the Iliad, the Odyssey, the old German fairy tales, the Irish fairy tales, and then our equivalent of modern myth today in the sense of Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn, Fitzgerald, and so on. So I grew up with myth in the blood, right? So in many ways, I was ready for Joe Campbell when I finally met him. But to get you into the mood of that, and in honor of my friend, the poet David White here tonight, I want to begin with a little short prose poem from my most recent book, The Blue Museum. The title, coming from a little encounter I had with a Greek fisherman in the island of Naxos years ago, when I was out, like a good reporter, 5 o'clock in the morning, seeing the fishing boats coming in and saying, "What did you bring in? What did you haul in the nets?" And so the old Greek fisherman says, a little shark, a little squid, names all these Greek fish I don't know, and he says, "And once in a while, a statue. And that's why we call her, the sea, the Blue Museum." Isn't that a beautiful metaphor? I heard this 20 years ago, and I knew this is a book title. Someday I'm going to use this. It's a terrific metaphor for memory, isn't it? Throwing the nets overboard, hauling up the treasures from the bottom of the sea. So this is a piece called The Way of the World, since tonight we're going to talk about journeys, paths, the ways, and see if you can recognize who I'm describing here. By the time the old archivist had turned 160 years old, he'd grown weary of the corruption of the ruling class in palace life. No one listened to the wisdom of the old ways anymore. No one scoffed at the wisdom he had winnowed from the most venerable books left behind by the ancestors. There was only one thing that would bring him the peace of mind. Like the Taoist masters before him, he had to leave the velvet cage of the Middle Kingdom and spend his remaining years in the hardscrabble mountain life. The old man quietly left late one night under a sceptered moon, rode in a rickety chariot pulled by a lumbering black ox, and this would be his last journey. He rolled on for many days through the dangerous trail called the Han Ku Pass. And when he finally reached the last border gate, he was unceremoniously stopped by a young soldier named Yin His, the keeper of the pass. He claimed to be less than surprised by the old man's arrival. The border guard had been reading the clouds, watching the flight of birds, paying attention to the rainfall. And the omens predicted everything, that you, old man, are about to withdraw yourself from the real world. I pray you compose a book for me before you leave. The wizened sage pulled at his white beard, adjusted the reins of his chariot. He had not expected this. He knew that whatever he said would not be the way, that the way of the world could not be said. "Have faith in the way things are," he wanted to say. "The way is the way of Wu Wei, the way of not doing but being." It took him 5,000 characters to say this. In a work compiled later by the Keeper of the Pass and later called the Tao Te Ching and credited to the old man we now know as Lao Tzu. The old sage could not have known this. He shrugged his shoulders, adjusted his courtly robes, and left for the farthest passes of the West, rolling where there was nowhere there. The keeper of the pass told those that followed that the old man's chariot wheels left no tracks, no way. That's how we got the Tao Te Ching, by a man who refused to believe that there were words to describe this undescribable path. And it's a setup for me to describe to you that I am fairly astonished to be standing here 19 years after meeting my old friend Joe Campbell, because I worked with him for 8 years, between 1979 and 1987, in a time when we were rebuffed by virtually every source for raising money to make a movie about Joe's life, except for the Jung Institute of San Francisco. They gave us $40,000 to get started. But everybody else, including PBS, which is still showing our film, by the way, The Hero's Journey, which told us, and I remember this explicitly, the American public will not sit still for an hour to listen to an old man tell old stories. And I guarantee within the next few weeks, you'll turn on PBS and they'll say, "Your donations go to financing great films like this, The Hero's Journey, Joseph Campbell. So I find it ironic that back in the 70s and then early 80s, mid 80s, there was a kind of disdain for the old way, the old stories. And yet, as we kept going with this film, we believed that the hunger was going to be there. And it astonishes me that the hunger is still there, because the film, which became part of a cultural phenomenon, has been partly responsible for igniting a whole revival in this wonderful realm of mythology. So I thank you for Joe and for Jean, his wife, who is still around, 89 years old, in Honolulu. And thank you for coming tonight. So the little convergence that I want to describe to you tonight came about from the result of 8 years of making the film, The Hero's Journey, when we premiered in Hollywood at the Directors Guild of all places in May of 1987. We showed the film, we gathered up on stage afterwards, Joe and Stuart Brown and a number of us who had worked on the film, and we opened up the evening to questions. And the final question of the night was one of those great, overarching, ambitious questions that only people like the Dalai Lama, Houston Smith, and Joe Campbell get. The world's going to hell in a handbasket. Your work has helped a lot, but what can you tell us now to keep us from ultimate calamity? I'm paraphrasing, but that's generally the tone of the question. So I was up there on stage, and I thought Campbell was going to say, read more Greek myths. I thought, he loved the Greek myths so much, it saved him. That's what he'd recommend. I looked down at his wife in the front row, and she was saying, she told me later, I thought he would say, read more James Joyce. Then we went, later on at dinner, we went all across the front row, and everybody thought something different. Finally, Joe took a long pause and came out with a one-word answer. Tourism. It shocked all of us. But then, like a good Irish storyteller, he waited for the laughter to die down in the hall, 700 people at the Directors Guild. And then his voice took on a great deal of gravitas. And that's when he said, go out and meet someone new. Learn their language. Learn their religion. Learn their poetry. Learn their myths. And if you do that, and if enough of you do that, we will stop demonizing the other. Remember, he had just been filmed in Sam Kean's still highly significant film, The Faces of the Enemy, which won an Emmy that year for its depiction of propaganda, the whole mythology of propaganda. It's still out in video, and I highly recommend that. So later on, Joe, of course, confided to me that what he meant was that this was a sophisticated kind of tourism. What he meant was pilgrimage, that there was a whole other way to travel in the world, and that it was a parallel track to what he had been describing for many years in his work on the hero with a thousand faces, and so on. So tonight I want to give you a couple parallel visions of these two. I'll show you a clip from our film, The Hero's Journey, which is still out there, and then I'll show you an outtake from one of the interviews that I did with him that is shockingly and heartbreakingly fading to me. When I look at this, you can see the whole phenomenon of what's happening to film virtually all around the world, that the colors fade. What was so pristine 20 years ago when we filmed Campbell, you'll see here, is deteriorating rapidly. And so I'm going to show you to help maybe prod you into getting involved with organizations like the American Film Institute. Send $10, help save Citizen Kane. Somebody out there help save these movies. And then I'm going to take you on a little round, what I call the round in my book, The Art of Pilgrimage, the seven stages of what I see as the hero's journey that's adapted into the world of sacred travel, sacred journeys. So these are about 40, 45 slides that I've taken in my travels from Ireland to Easter Island, and I've customized them for tonight to include a number of slides of places that Joe actually traveled to in his own prodigious travels around the world. Because People often ask me why the American public was seized by Campbell, and let's say not Mircea Eliade or other scholars of myth. Why are people taking now to Houston Smith, who I just lectured with at UCLA last week, and not other scholars of religion? One big difference is that both of them, Houston and Joe, tried to live the work. They were both prodigious readers, but also extensive travelers. So they would read, they would study, they would write, and then they would move halfway around the world to see if those ideas could take root. Matter of fact, once Joe said, the problem of being a writer, Phil, is that it cuts into your reading time. Is that true for anybody who loves writing, right? Okay, so a little setup for this first clip. In the film, we had shot 75 hours of Campbell over the course of 8 years. And if any of you have ever worked in film, you know you've got to find a through line, a spine for something like this. And, of course, the spine that emerged from Joe's vision was that of the journey. But he was always describing the journey on two levels. There's the outer journey to the physical place, and then there's the inward journey, which is the... Let's keep it on pause for a second. And so as a filmmaker, what you're then challenged with is how do you illustrate something like that? Because his notion of the hero journey is that it's the quest for the self. This is something that he borrowed from Jung, the quest for the deep self, as in capital S. It's the journey of self-fulfillment. It's an adventure of self-knowledge. There are many metaphors for this journey, but it's always to the center. So it's the circle that becomes the spiral. Remember John Muir once said, I found myself walking out one day into the woods, and I realized halfway through the day that I was really walking into my own soul. Very similar sensibility with Campbell, that the journey is into the self where the lost energy that you need to go forward with your life is. So I came up with the notion then of illustrating this with mandalas. Seven mandalas representing seven different cultures, mandala being the old Sanskrit word for soul, which is then the setup for our brief explanation of the hero journey. Okay, let him roll.
Real theme of writing very, very exciting. And whether it was Finnegan's Wake or the Navajo material or the Hindu material of Patrick Simmons, it was all the same material. That was when I realized, and nobody can tell me anything differently, that there's one mythology in the world, and it has inflected in the various cultures in terms of their historical and social circumstances, and needs, and particular. $250 on signing the contract, $250 on the book, and finished $250 on the book. than he did. So I worked for 4 or 5 years. Was the hero without faith. What it is my first lecture to my students.
The hero with a thousand faces is the synthesis of years of work. In his book, Campbell outlined his idea of the hero's journey that he had seen repeated in cultures throughout the world. He saw the hero as a personification of a culture's mythology. Traditionally, the hero might be a warrior, the ideal of strength and courage. An explorer, the founder of civilizations. A philosopher, an adventurer of the mind. And in the modern world, Campbell would add the artist and the scientist to the pantheon of heroes. But the journey is essentially the same. One shape-shifting story of the vision quest that transforms the world. Whether it is Odysseus, King Arthur, or Luke Skywalker, the hero is the one who responds to the call to adventure. The story is often open, the hero appearing restless. Something is missing in life. There is a feeling of destiny. It is a time for separation. Sometimes it takes a shock to make the final break from the past and gain courage to accept the call. But no one can go it alone. Everyone needs a mentor to provide wisdom and magical power.
I suggest you try it again, Luke. This time, let go of your conscious self and act on instinct. Stretch out of your feelings. See, you can do it.
The descent into the underworld of adventure is often blocked by strange and dangerous threshold guardians. They mark the point of no return. Beyond them is the region of the unknown. A dreamlike labyrinth of tests and trials. To pass this initiation, the hero must become a dragon slayer.
Is that the dictation of your own eternity, you have You're in hell.
Thanks. So there's a little tease for you from our film. When we were putting this together, in the space of 1 year, Stanley Kubrick from 2001 Space Odyssey, George Miller, who had just finished The Road Warrior, Kurosawa over in Japan, Coppola, Spielberg, and Lucas all came out in interviews saying how much Campbell's writing, and especially The Hare with a Thousand Faces, had helped. The Grateful Dead did the music for our film as a thank you to Campbell because he helped them understand the mythic power of their bizarre power over the world's public. That same year, when we came out with the film, I gave a talk down at UCLA, and Alex Haley's wife came up to me during one of the breaks and said, my husband Alex wanted to be here tonight, but he fell ill. He just wanted you to know how much Joe's books meant to him. It was reading The Hero that put him on the boat to go to Africa to do the research for Roots. I got a letter from Jackie Kennedy Onassis after my book came out, thanking me and thanking Joe, the spirit of Joe, and so on, because she said reading The Hero is what helped her get through the grief of her husband's assassination. It goes on and on. I must have a box full of 1,000 letters from people around the world. I gave a talk at Stanford 2 nights ago, and someone came up. I was giving a talk to volunteers who are helping at-risk kids, 9 to 13 years old. And I was telling them how much it can help to get kids to read, give them books, show them this pattern of the journey, and that the darkness that so many kids feel in youth does not have to be literalized. And the more stories you read, the more it can give you courage to keep going, even in youth. So during the break, one of the women came up and said, well, I've just come back from a journey. I just rode across the Atlantic, and you'll never guess what book I took with me. Only one book, but it was The Hare with a Thousand Faces. So the power of this goes on. It's remarkable to me. I'm doing some consultation right now in Hollywood and in movies, doing some, what do they call it, EC, some commentary on movies, the mythic content. And there's a lot of desire right now for filmmakers to find out what kind of myth is operating in those stories. So I just did the commentary for The Natural, the Robert Redford baseball movie, Superman sequences, the big 5-disc sets coming out, and something for the Coen brothers recently because they're doing a modern adaptation of Huckleberry Finn. Unfortunately, they lost the story halfway through. So we're working on this, and I'm trying to give them the cliff notes to Campbell and the hero's journey, and somewhere they lost the heroism. But at least they're asking. They're asking for help out there. So where did Campbell get this vision? And where did he get the courage to come out with this statement? I want to show you about 8 or 10 minutes of an outtake that's only been shown in public once or twice, where you get a sense of Campbell's struggle when he was young. Part of this was a metaphysical struggle on his own part because he was raised Irish Catholic, and his big breakthrough was finding the American Indian mythology as a boy. And early on, his mythology of this is 6, 7, 8 years old, he already saw the parallels between Native American mythology and the mythology / religion of his Catholicism. And he began to squirm in the church pews, as a lot of us did when we were that age. And he says, from then on, I knew what I wanted to do with my life. So would you like to see some clips that only a handful of people have seen before? And there will be one short stretch in here, a few seconds, that where the screen goes white. But bear with me. That means we are switching film, and the second and third camera we're running, but the sound keeps going. It's worth it to hear them.
This is 1988.
1985, shot out in Honolulu, in Hawaii, very close to where Joe and Jean got their condo. Okay. See how faded the picture is? It's heartbreaking.
When they are really deeply interested in myth as a life structure, they're not something that's fantasy out there, but deeply significant fantasy. 9 out of 10 of them happens. I've been interested in what happens to people when they leave their religions, you know. Protestants and Jews become psychologists and sociologists, and Catholics become poets. That's true. <true. laughs> Yeah. Well, the Arthurian romances are right out of the Celtic world. They are transformations of Celtic heroes into medieval knights. Every single one of them has a Celtic background. And my affinity for the material, I'm sure, has to do with my actual inheritance. And then the fact that James Joyce grabbed me, you know, that's it. And that wonderful living in a realm of significant fantasy, which is Irish. It's there in the Arthurian romances, it's in Joyce, and it's in my life.
Do you find that you identify with Stephen Nellis, the young woman who novel with Silence and Silence?
Well, his problem was my problem, exactly. Problem was, you know, you're deeply built into the system of the church, and you're losing your faith. It's no fun. I mean, it started when I was in studying biology, you know, there's absolutely no relationship between the biological, what we say, evolution of the human species. The animal and plant, all this world here, once you take the book of Genesis. And in those days, we were supposed to be believing in the stupid literacy, you know, of a text that goes back to 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries B.C. with a cosmology that dates from the 4th millennium B.C. And how can you go through life with that? Well, I couldn't anyhow, and yet this other thing had been built in, and the problem was to work it out, so Joyce did also. The thing that saved me was the Upanishads, Hinduism, where you have practically the same mythology, but it has been intellectually interpreted. Let's say that already in the 9th century BC, the Hindus realized that all the deities are projections of psychological powers, and they are within you, not out there. They're out there also in a certain way, in a mysterious way, but the real replacement is here. Boy, that saved the whole day.
About when in your life did that realization?
Well, you know, when did I finish this? 1923. I was then around 19 years old, and it came in a very interesting way. I was on a boat with my family going to Europe, and we used to take these slower boats, not the big ones that get you across in about 5 days, but the 10-day crossings, because it was such fun on those boats. And they were single-class boats, President Harding, President this, that, and the other. And one trip in 1923, there were three dark young men seated in steamer chairs, on deck chairs. And I noticed that there was a young woman who knew them. And I'd not seen such people before, because we never saw Hindus over here. Never. They would all end up in England, you know. They never got to the United States. It'd be the first Hindu they ever saw. Well, that happened that one of them was Chidu Krishnamurti, another was his brother Nityananda, and his secretary at that time, Radical Power. So when I met them, this was my introduction to the world of Indian. And the young woman who introduced me gave me Edwin Arnold's The Light of Asia, which is the life of the Buddha from the sutras. And that was the opening, and it was like a light for me. So when I went to Europe as a student of literature, philology, romance literature first, and then I went to Germany and started my Sanskrit. There was the Sanskrit, and there was all this stuff again, so I really got into it then in those years. But it had started with the what I learned from that little book about the Buddha. Strange, just a little touch like that and everything changes. I had an earlier change. As I said, when I was in prep school, I was interested in biology and mathematics. And it was true also in my freshman year at Stanford. But in the interval between the freshman and sophomore years, somebody gave me Mary Schakowsky's Romance of Leonardo da Vinci. My God, I realized I didn't know anything about the world of art and culture and civilization. I knew about American Indians, but not about our civilization. Then my whole thing shifted. That's what did that one. Then this later little one on Buddha didn't add another direction.
You once said you wanted to be a synthesis of Da Vinci and Douglas Fairbanks.
Well, when I was a kid, Douglas Fairbanks was a magnificent performer and a beautiful man, doing fantastic things. There was one great show, I think of some pirate thing, but he was a pirate. And somebody chased him up the mast of a boat, and then he takes his knife and puts it in the sail, and he comes down that sail, and I don't forget this. Well, the guy that could do that kind of thing. And then, with respect to the world of the intellect, I was never interested, really, finally, in small, specialized studies. I think they tend to dehumanize you anyhow. And this wonderful, majestic translation of everything into human values, Leonardo da Vinci seemed to me to represent that, or he did early in my days. The Romance of Leonardo is what turned me on. So that was there. You know, you have to have some kind of silly thing on the front to keep you on the line. Probably difficult to do. Is this the kind of stuff you wanted?
Well, is this the kind of stuff you wanted? It was funny. A couple of weeks after I handed in my book, The Hero's Journey, the companion book to this film, I found some telephone notes. We don't do this anymore because we're just emailing each other. Nobody talks to each other anymore. But I have shoeboxes full of handwritten notes from all my phone calls with Campbell over the years. And in one of them, I asked him on the phone as we were editing, I said, I know it's going to come up, Joe. How do you know if you're on the journey? I mean, psychotics think they're on a journey too, right? How do you know it's the real thing? And I remember him pausing for quite a while and then saying, you've got to ask yourself how much synchronicity there is in your life. If you're on the real path, things are clicking. There are magical moments. If you're on the wrong path, and he would usually say, if you're trying to be a lawyer because your dad wanted you to be a lawyer and you really wanted to be a poet, if you're taking, you're going in the opposite direction of where your destiny or fate lies, that's when there isn't any magic or mystery. People aren't returning your phone calls. People don't laugh at your jokes. So ask yourself how much synchronicity there is. And this was early 1987. I was about to head off to Paris to lead one of my tours there, art and literary tour. And I told him at that time I was also going to try to go and find some of the graves of the Cousineaus, because the Cousineaus on both sides of my family. My mom is a Lachance, Lachance du Papin de Paris. So there are lots of Lachances and Cousineaus there. And I remember Joe saying, oh, so you're going on a pilgrimage. And no one had ever used the word like that before. But he added, and I found this in another note, he said, when I look back over my life, and that's when he quotes Schopenhauer, some of you know this reference, where he says, our life unfolds like a good novel if we're leading the life we're supposed to. And so as you grow older, you can look back, and it seems that there are entire periods of your life that are chapters within this novel. And Joe was now in his early 80s, and he says, when I look back, I see that when I needed to meet someone, I met them at this significant period. When he had, for example, in the 1930s, when he was suffering under a crushing depression, the only one he really ever had to endure, a woman who's the nutritionist, what's her name? Adele Davis. Do you remember Adele Davis, the nutritionist? She was one of Joe's early girlfriends. They actually met on the ship coming back from this trip with Krishnamurti. See, he's the Zelig of scholars. Remember the Woody Allen movie who bumps into J. Edgar Hoover and Babe Ruth and so on? That's Campbell. Campbell's the Zelig of scholars. Well, Adele said, I have a friend out in Carmel, you know, way out there in California, who's a writer, and maybe he would help you get through this. So Joe didn't even ask who the guy's name was. He just took his mother's Model A, drove all the way across America, met up with Adele Davis in San Jose, drove down to Carmel, and met John Steinbeck. Spent 2 years living with Steinbeck, fell in love with his wife. That's a whole other story. But as Joe said later on, this was the first time a professional writer ever took him seriously as a writer. And he felt it was because he made this leap. He took this journey. He knew he had to air it out, so to speak. So in that sense, when you read that quote that I had in the brochure describing tonight, that's a significant insight that Campbell has, that the hero journey is the psychological descent. You can take a hero journey if you're in prison. By the way, I have a thing going with prisoners in Folsom and San Quentin and others. I send books to them. I get my publishers to send books because people have forgotten them. I get a tremendous amount of mail from prisoners who read about pilgrimage, who read about mythology and say, this is giving me a map, a life map now. So you see, everybody is in a journey of some kind if you can lay out the map for them. But the pilgrimage is the physical enactment of that journey. In a sense, it's faith in action. So in a gentle segue here, I want to now move into the pilgrimage material. Do you know where the word comes from? It's from the Old Latin, which was per agrum. And it means to go through the fields. It means get off the bus, get out of your car, get out of the classroom, and put the soles of your feet to the sole of the earth. It's the kind of journey. Remember William Saroyan's old definition of the writer? A writer is someone who can't write. Isn't that a great double negative? So in a sense, the pilgrim is the one who can't travel. It usually comes in a crisis, a spiritual crisis. Life just cannot go on the way that it's been going. Something, as Joe would say in the hero journey, the hero is restless. Life has come to a dead halt. That's where the story begins. If you notice, we never tell stories about how things stay the same. Stories only begin when there is a radical shift, a radical change. So pilgrimage is quite different from other forms of travel. Travel comes from travail. And underneath the word travail is the old Latin trapalium, which meant the medieval rack. So I like to think that travel can either be torture or a way to stretch you, depends on your imagination, right? As a tour leader, I happen to often remind people of this. All right, so the orange juice is cold, or the orange juice is hot and the coffee is cold. Well, what's your attitude towards it? So travail, travel is travail. It's an old Arab expression. Travel is difficult. Tourism simply comes from the word tour. It means the round. And we have the original poster of the first tour group that ever left, at least in the West. Thomas Cook of Thomas Cook Traveler's Checks advertised a trip from the north of England down to the Crystal Palace in London in the 1830s. And the original poster said, "No surprises guaranteed." There you are. There's the difference right there. There's a lot of fear. Up until the mid-19th century, it's estimated that half of the world travelers never came home again. That's the estimate. Travel was so dangerous because travelers always had money. And so remember the footpads, that great old English word, the footpads, the robbers, the bandits were always looking for travelers. They were the ones to rob. Pilgrims usually dressed differently, so generally speaking, they were protected by an aura of sanctity. They were generally left alone, but other travelers didn't. So you've got tours, people in tourism, seeing the surface of things, being entertained, and being very concerned with predictability, that they won't be poisoned in the hotel restaurant, that they won't be robbed in their room. I remember traveling in Portugal years ago with an old girlfriend and leaving for one day to go to Lisbon. And when I came back the next morning, she said she had had to push the bed, all of the furniture in the room up to the door because the men downstairs had seen me leave and heard me say I was going to be out of town for 24 hours. So they were trying to get into her room the whole time I was gone. She was absolutely terrified. And women, you in the audience, you know exactly what I'm talking about, right? There was a measure of fear for women that men don't have with traveling. But this is also the mythic dimension of travel. It's the drop down into dreamtime. This is why pilgrimage is much more mythic than other forms of travel. You are leaving the ordinary world, and you're dropping down into what Campbell called the night world, the world of unseen forces, unseen powers, but that's also where your destiny lies. So pilgrimage, the way that I think about it now after writing about it for years and taking tours all over, pilgrimage is a journey of transformation to a sacred place. When you go to Club Med, your neighbors don't expect you to be different when you come home. But if you go to Mecca or Santiago or Jerusalem, there's a different kind of expectation in you and in your family when you come back. A lot of people say, "Kuzno, I can't talk to you since you've been to Paris. I just can't have a conversation with you." Thank you. So it's a journey of transformation to a sacred place. And then one more note on that, and we'll go into slides. The question, of course, is why can't you change at home? There are a lot of psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists in the room, right? I hope this isn't threatening. But the notion of pilgrimage is the last resort after your friends, your family, and your therapist can't help you. And it's been like that probably for 60,000 years. If you count the walkabout tradition with Australian Aborigines or the vision quest tradition with Native Americans, which is at least 10,000 years old, human beings, men and women alike, have been going on these journeys to encounter the numinous, to encounter the sacred, in places, as Joe writes beautifully in the mythic image, places that are inexhaustibly spiritual, so that you don't go to Notre Dame once and say, "Been there, done that." You don't go to the old megalithic sites in the west of Ireland once and just say, "Oh, I don't need to go there again." It's a little bit like saying, "I heard Beethoven once. Why? I saw Vermeer once. Why do I need to go back and see that again?" There is something about art and the sacred in the dimension that we're going to try to explore now that is inexhaustible. It's beyond time and beyond place. The Irish have the strongest phrase that I've come across in years. They call these the thin places. So I'm going to show you 40, 45 slides here that are all in this area called the thin place. And that's this dimension in which you walk into the Field of Dreams in Iowa. You know, it's one of the most popular pilgrimage places in America. You know, there are daily flights from Tokyo, Japan, to go to Fairfield, Iowa, to take baseball pilgrims to the place where the Kevin Costner movie was shot. There are flights every day into San Jose to take technology pilgrims to the garage where Hewlett and Packard first began the computer movement. You notice the principle here? The pilgrimage is against time. It goes back and down to a place where it all began, where the faith of your people began, perhaps where your story began, where something profound and earth-shattering happened, like the fields of Normandy in World War I, World War II. But the pilgrimage is not in clockwise format. The pilgrimage is always back and down. And that's why it feels like you're stopping time when you're on a great trip. Have you ever had that happen? You come back and everybody else's life has gone forward 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 weeks, and you feel like time stood still. It's a profound thing, isn't it? I live for it. I don't know about you guys. But there's a reason for it that I'd like to explore now. So if you guys want to roll your shoulders for a minute, we'll bring the lights down and we'll rondelay around the world, and then we'll open it up for questions. In the traditional hero's journey, which Campbell cobbled together from Jung, Freud, Mann, Joyce, and Victor Turner, who wrote probably the definitive book on rites of passage, in the sense that all adolescents have to have a separation from childhood in order to make the transition, the great transit into adulthood. So in some ways, the hero's journey is the youthful journey to become the adult, to find your place in the world, and as he wrote in many, many sources, to find your destiny. It begins with a sense of unrest, dissatisfaction, sometimes outrage. And the equivalent mood for me in pilgrimage is the sense that something is ending and just about to begin. If you need to travel for entertainment, that's fine, but that's for another mood, another phase of your life. But the pilgrimage is always the spiritual journey as a response to being debilitated spiritually. You don't believe what you did. Your faith is not working anymore. And so I use this slide that I shot in Greece last year when I went to the Olympics. I just finished my book on the Olympics. And this notion of the sun setting seems very symbolic to me. Something is setting. Maybe your marriage is ending. Your job, your vocation is ending. Your belief in a certain movement. Something is coming to an end and about to be reborn. In 1995, I got a... I can't sit. I'm sorry. I'm sorry I'm blocking some of you here. I'll try to move. Maybe I can take this mic off. Excuse me for a second here. Okay. How's that? A little better? In 1995, don't get any feedback. Hello. I got a postcard from some relatives in Canada saying that there was going to be a Cousineau family reunion up in Lake Nipissing, and would you like to come? So there's a call. It's the call to adventure. It could come in a book. When I was in Prague years ago, I met a woman who had come there because she had been reading Milan Kundera books all her life, and she felt that there was something unlived, that's the word she used, unlived in her, and she had to go to Prague. So it's a call. It can come in a dream, a book, a movie, a conversation with a friend. My call came in a postcard for a family reunion, but what was numinous for me about it was the call that said, a few of us are going to take canoes down the French River to go to the lake where our people, the Cousineaux, came from. We're going to be going in the footsteps of Charlemagne, my great-great-great-grandfather, Charlemagne, Charlemagne Cousineaux. Would you like to go? Right then and there, you know you're in the pilgrim mood, because pilgrimages are in the footsteps. You're following in the footsteps of others, in a sense of tribute, not rote. You know, both Martin Luther and Carl Jung had one thing in common. They were adverse to pilgrimage, because they thought it led to undisciplined thought, a kind of herd mentality. But my point of view on it with this is that there is a healing force to dropping the guise of, let's say, out of control or berserk individualism if it's in the honor of something. And I'll explore that a little more. Anyway, my wife Jo and I, we got into canoes with 19 other cousins. We paddled 25 miles a day for 5 days, which we thought was great until we heard that our ancestors did 75 miles a day. They were voyageurs. But when we arrived, there were 3,000 Cousineaux waiting for us on the banks in the morning mist. And what did we do for 3 days? We told stories. We pieced the story together. And in a simple but elegant way, I think this is part of the power of pilgrimage. There is a piece of your story that's missing, and you can't get it at home. This is why you need to go back and reclaim the story. To do this, to get into a kind of pilgrim mood, there are two things that I point out in my book. Intention, inattention. It separates us from tourists. If you move in a sense of reverence, respect, curiosity, a sense of purpose, the road underneath your foot, underneath your feet, if it's Route 66 or the Appian Way here in Rome, becomes a sacred way. So there are two points of evidence of how ancient this impulse is. There's the walkabout in Australia that still goes on to this day. There are reports in Australian newspapers almost daily that someone walked off a construction site in Sydney and went on walkabout because they heard the voice of the ancestors. If you want to pursue this, Bruce Chatwin's book, The Songlines, is magnificent. Here, these are the cave paintings from Lascaux, where I was privileged to go a few years ago. And it was one of Joe's favorite places in the world. He wrote about this beautifully in The Masks of God. He was absolutely certain that this was a place of pilgrimage. These were our first cathedrals, our first art galleries, and places of initiation. You don't walk in like you would into a museum today. You had to crawl into these caves as if you were going into the womb. So they were far, far away from living quarters. And for Joe, it was 20,000 years ago. So now they're being dated back in Chauvet and others, 27,000 years old. And now most of them are cordoned off because of... human breath is destroying a lot of the paintings. But you can get permission to go into some of them. So that tradition is 27,000 years old. Another one of Joe's favorite sites was Delphi in Greece. That this, for him and for me, has become one of the great metaphors for pilgrimage in this sense, that you are leaving home with a question that can't be answered at home. And when I lead my tours, I actually put people in, and I encourage them to do a practice where every day they remind themselves of the question that they left home with, and they try to resolve it in a writing or a drawing practice. At Delphi, there's a curious nuance to the pilgrimage here. Everybody was equal in front of the Delphic Oracle. You could be a farmer, a soldier, or an emperor. You were all equal before the Oracle. But when you asked your question, here we get the first evidence of psychotherapy. The Oracle never answered your question directly. It's like a therapist saying, well, what do you think? For at least 1,200 years, the Oracle answered either in a riddle or in poetry. And then the priest would say, you're all done. You can walk home now. And the notion was that you had to walk 500 miles back to Athens and figure out what the riddle meant. I find this pretty tantalizing. Roger Lipsy has written a wonderful book about this. We have about 112 responses that have been written down by the old commentators, if you're interested in this history. Olympia, still one of the oldest pilgrimage sites. It was the greatest pilgrimage site in antiquity. We think of it just as high testosterone athletes, but it was a religious festival. This is the Temple of Hera. And right where that woman is standing, a member of my group there, that's where the torch is lit every 4 years that goes around the world to the different games. And they're estimating about 250,000 people a year went, walking, taking chariots, taking donkeys from all corners of the Mediterranean in honor of Zeus and all forms of competition. The games were the athletic games were only the last competition. They had drinking contests, kissing contests, drama, riddle making, wine making, and then on the last 3 days, they had the athletic events. David probably knows this site, Pool na Breon in the west of Ireland, estimated to be about 6,000 years old. This would have been covered with dirt or earth originally, and then the heroes or chieftains would have been born inside. The kind of homeopathic principle being that that is the form of the vulva. That's Mother Earth herself. The Irish believed in metempsychosis or reincarnation. And so if you planted or replanted, reseeded the earth in the old days, it would have been the Druid priests come back and they look at you and discover either you are dead, mad, or a poet. That's the old expression, dead, mad, or a poet. One of Joe's favorite sites is the Glastonbury Cathedral. Underneath that arch is believed to be the burial site of Arthur and Guinevere. So since the 6th century, it's been a pilgrimage site for literary lovers, but also those who are fascinated by the origins of England, English culture itself. This myth and this site was particularly powerful for Joe because when he was in graduate school, he found the story of Parsifal from the King Arthur legends. And in that one moment when Gawain says, "Hey, dudes, I think we should go on a quest," then comes the key line that I think became the Ariadne's thread through the rest of Campbell's work, the rest of his life. And the translation is something like this. They thought that it would be a disgrace to go as a group. Each would go on the quest and enter the dark forest where there was no way or path. Because if there was a path, it was someone else's adventure. Right then and there, remember Emily Dickinson's description of real poetry, real truth? If you feel like the top of your head is being blown off, that's how Campbell described the moment of discovery of that line. Because there is something indestructibly individualistic about us that we resist going as a group. So Glastonbury was one of Campbell's fondest sites. Here's another one. This is Dante's home in Florence. And according to legend, it was right on those cobbled streets that he first saw Beatrice. And the moment they had this vision of this, they say, 14-year-old girl, kindled his imagination for the rest of his life. He wrote off of that numinous moment, that epiphany, until the day he died. Campbell was asked in the Bill Moyers interview, The Power of Myth, about contemporary heroes. He said, Joe, what do you think about someone like John Lennon? And remember, Joe's response was interesting. He said, well, those young men, the Beatles, right? Those young men are modern heroes. And he said, that John Lennon, he's a hero because he was an innovator. That's an interesting way to think about the hero. The hero or the creative artist. In one of my favorite passages of Campbell, says, the creative artist is bringing forth something that the world has never seen before. And that's only possible by going on a rigorous descent into the psyche. If you don't take the hero journey as a creative soul, you will be repetitive, derivative. You will write, paint, sing like everyone else before you. And so this site was created by Yoko Ono just a handful of years ago. It's called Strawberry Fields, and it's probably 100 yards from the Dakota Hotel where Lennon was shot a number of years ago. So I was there just a few months back, and there must have been 100 young Beatle lovers from all around the world softly singing songs and throwing flowers on the site. It's in Central Park, and it's an example for me of the absolute spontaneous impulse that we have to pilgrimage. It is not a conspiracy by the authorities. There's no one that is telling us to go to these sites. They come up spontaneously. Go and see the spontaneous ritual at Mia Lai's Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, and you will see people running their fingers across the names of the dead, just like they run their fingers across the wall of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem. There is a deep, deep need. Oh, my gosh, that's right. Thank you for that. 26 years ago today, John Lennon was killed. In some ways, the archetypal pilgrimage in the West, and I want to make that clear, in the West, is the journey to Jerusalem. This is a 15th century painting pointing towards a model of Solomon's Temple. And the inscription underneath was, those who are in sin, those who are having a crisis of faith, need to hie yourself, H-I-E, an old verb, to the temple. Because there was a belief that you could erase your sins if you made this long, long journey. And so many people of faith throughout the Middle Ages did. However, it became a terrible crisis when the rich hired peasants to take the journey for them to erase their sins. I think it's like air credits today. You can pollute the environment, but you can sell the credits to somebody. But the point of that archetypal image, though, is that all the great sites from Ethiopia to Greece, Rome to Jerusalem, have this kind of image of paradise. It's a place, you know, paradise is an old Arabic word for walled garden. All great sacred sites have this archetypal force that it is set off from ordinary life. It is set off. And if you go back to the garden, like a great Van Morrison song, got to go back to the garden, somehow you will be reborn. That's the psychological model that Edinger describes beautifully in his book on Moby Dick, that if you do not have the energy to go forward with your life, you need to go back and down into the underworld, into a sacred place to get it. Remember Kierkegaard's line, life must be understood backwards, but lived forwards. There's some truth to that here. A few years after my book came out, I got a series of 12 slides by this woman artist in Berkeley, Alexandra Etheridge, who wrote to me and said, Phil, I love your book, it's wonderful, but there's one thing you don't talk about enough, feet. She says, you talk a lot about God and sacred places, but if you're really walking, you think more about your feet than you do about God. So she did a whole series on her own feet and then beautifully added those spirals. You know, you see that motif there? And she got it right on, that the pilgrimage is the journey to the center. That's what the spiral motif is about. It's the oldest symbol we probably have for the life force. Think of the spiral in the galaxies, the spiral in the child's hair coming out of the mother's womb. The spiral is the journey to the center. So I have a long series now of photos of pilgrims' feet around the world. There's someone who earned her pilgrimage. One of the things to consider before leaving on a trip is that your journey, if it's the real thing, will be full of obstacles. So how can you anticipate this? The Dalai Lama recently said, I was involved in a conference with him in San Francisco, and he was saying one of the four practices that can help us earn world peace in the future is pilgrimage. And he said it's because it allows you to have more compassion for other people by going to a strange land, and also it gives you the pleasure of overcoming obstacles. That's absolutely right for a real pilgrimage. And this is Ganesh, who is the god of writing. He's the patron saint of writers, but also the patron saint of travelers. So in India, a lot of Asian or Hindu countries, you make some kind of obeisance, some kind of honoring to the God who can help you remove obstacles. So now here are a short series of slides that I think represent the way to shift the mood from what I feel is a very aggressive model in traveling to the pilgrim one. What do you see in this man's face, in his eyes? I shot this in the deep Amazon. I was working on a film about architecture, and we got into a non-contact tribes village deep in the Amazon near the French and Guinea border. They'd only had two sets of visitors before, so we were, for all intents and purposes, from outer space. And that look is the look that's written about in myths, fairy tales, legends for 10,000 years. It's the look of suspicion. Am I going to do something to hurt his little girl? Am I carrying something that will poison the well? There's a whole series of stories of blaming and killing travelers throughout the Middle Ages who poison wells. Every traveler, I think, has to consider the psychodynamics of this, that when you're traveling, you're a stranger. And if you go as a tourist, there is something aggressive. Think about the words we use. I'm going to take a trip. I'm going to take a photograph. I think I'll take home some souvenirs. There's something aggressive about that. But the pilgrim model, for as long as we've recorded it, is a model of giving versus taking. You bring a gift if you are a pilgrim. If you're going home to see your family in Detroit, you don't go home with your hands empty. In this case, I was shooting a film on peyote religion, which ended up getting shown in Congress and helping overturn a Supreme Court law. And Native Americans came from all over Central America, and every one of them, dirt poor, but they all brought gifts to this 5-day peyote ceremony. In Lithuania, the Hill of Crosses, it's been a custom for 150 years that when you go to this site where the Lithuanians won their freedom, you bring a cross with you. So let's take a pause and think for a minute now of the significant journeys you've made over the last few years. Have you brought gifts with you? Have you ever been on a journey where you felt a little off kilter because you were empty-handed? That you didn't bring something? For example, the wells. There are hundreds of sacred wells all around Ireland. And the Irish will bring a photograph of someone who's ill, a piece of cloth, a coin. It's a gesture. It's a psychological gesture of exchange, because it feels wrong to the soul to be getting so much from a sacred place without giving something back. So a few of these practices, talking to an elder before you leave, thinking about bringing gifts along, can change any trip into a pilgrimage. I was on CNN a few years ago about the pilgrimage book, and they completely ambushed me with the first question. I was ready to go on like droning about how pilgrimage can change your life. Instead they say, what about if you're on a business trip? What does this book have to say to business travelers, Mr. Cousineau? I did not see that one coming. So I had to think quickly because, you know, dead air on the radio is dead. They will cut you off. So instead I said, well, of course this book talks to business travelers, thinking about all those great business books, businessmen buying books in airports. So I said, you can think of it as a micro-pilgrimage. You're going on a business trip. Take postcards with you. Well, But then I also said, even if you're on a business trip, take 10 minutes, take a half hour out of every day to renew yourself. That's the central psychological function of the pilgrimage. It's the journey that renews you. And if you're not renewing yourself, either on a family trip or a business trip, you come home grumpy. You come home resentful, your wife doesn't want to see you, and your dog runs away from you. So some of these, if you're carrying a spiritual question in your heart, then you are walking what the Katha Upanishads called the razor's edge. This is a walk to the temples of the rice gods in the Philippines, and I immediately thought of the razor's edge. Do you know that classic line? The path to the truth of your life is as narrow and dangerous to traverse as the edge of a razor. So if you are going on an authentic trip, you're on a spiritual crisis, you're in a crisis about your marriage, your work, and you go to a place that you think can heal you, you are upping the ante. And it means you've got to take that journey a little more seriously than others. I found a line in a 9th century travel guide that I reprised throughout my book, The Art of Pilgrimage. It's still mysterious. I think you could write a whole treatise on this. It goes like this. Pass by that which you do not love. The next time you travel, just echo that every day. It will change the way that you take that journey. If you don't, you reach a dead end. You become a resentful traveler. Sometimes you can become a rude traveler. You've come to a threshold. What have you, as Robert Bly says, well, what have you got to get past the threshold guardians? There are threshold guardians at the entrance to sacred sites everywhere. And the question is your heart in the right place? Because if you haven't done some rituals, some ceremony, then you'll say what the fella told me sitting with his back up against one of the standing stones at Stonehenge. He said, Australian fella told me he'd been traveling for 5 years around the world and no place had impressed him yet. It broke my heart to hear this. He had just gone numb. He hadn't prepared. He really didn't respect any of the places he had been. So he couldn't get past the threshold. The threshold is a sense of awe and wonder. This is what we'll talk about tomorrow with the film clips. This is Angkor Wat, the top prom temples there. I went there in honor of my father because the first book he ever gave me wasn't a book about the Detroit Tigers. It was a book about Cambodia. And I needed to go for him after he died. And I met a number of Buddhist monks who had escaped the Khmer Rouge. I was in a sense of utter awe. And I can date the rebirth of my life to this visit. A visit out of respect to a place like Nelson Mandela's cell in Cape Town, where I went with Houston Smith a couple of years ago working on a film. That's pilgrimage as homage. The peyote ceremony. These Indians went 500 miles. They ran 500 miles to participate in this journey. A recent pilgrimage I was on in Louisville, Kentucky, a peace march in honor of Gandhi and Merton that I led with Father John Deere. 60 miles in 4 days in honor of Gandhi, who made the non-violence vow 100 years ago in South Africa. That's Merton's monastery in the misty distance there. And as we left, that's Father John on the right and his father Paul, I believe, on the left, who lived with Merton for many years and is now in charge of editing his Posthuma. And we're getting a blessing as we're leaving. It's a very interesting practice. The next time you go on a sacred journey, something deeply significant to your soul, find an elder and tell him or her that you're leaving and ask for some kind of blessing. It's a very humbling practice. It works. I did this once in Paris here at the Shakespeare and Company where, you know, Joe Campbell went in indignantly in 1927 because he saw Joyce's book Ulysses in the window, tried to read 5 pages of it and went up to Sylvia Beach and said, "What is this goddamn stuff? I can't read a thing." So she took him in the back room and taught him how to read James Joyce. So then this bookstore in Paris became very important to me. And this man, George Whitman, the owner of it, has become a kind of mentor, pilgrim mentor for tens of thousands of travelers all over the world. And finally, the last few slides here. Taking a journey, coming to the end of it, I find a terrifically moving metaphor of travelers, pilgrims, having to touch something physical because they've been out of touch with their own psychic center. I watch it at the Vietnam Memorial. I've seen it at Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem. And so here, as we finished our pilgrimage after 4 days, 60 miles, we stopped in downtown Louisville where Merton had his epiphany in 1957. And he realized that he loved the rest of the human race and he had to dedicate himself to cross-cultural studies. So for our group, I said, just run your fingers across the words here and see what happens. And it was quite moving to see how people wept. It's a tradition in Paris to do the same thing. This is Michel Montaigne, the statue of him outside the Sorbonne. And if you walk by, you'll see that his boot is burnished, deep brown, because there's been a tradition for 200 years for a student to touch the boot of the Montaigne sculpture before they go in for exams. And it was just about 50 yards from here where Joe Campbell had his epiphany in 1927 in Paris when he was walking around this little park and he said, he got angry with himself and he says, I'm studying medieval French and I can't order a cup of coffee in a French cafe. This is a waste of my time. And he decided then and there to study comparative mythology. So the last couple here. On arrival, a couple of things to help lift your spirit, get ready for some kind of encounter. In Thailand, you can buy gold leaf and apply it to the statues because gold is the symbol of the pure spiritual character. You might light a candle. Candle lighting is a ritual in cultures clear across the world as evidence of leaving a little light in the darkness for those who've passed on before us. So that's my little boy there lighting a candle for my dad. A circumambulation, as we see here at Chichen Itza, is a way to, I think, wind up the sense of anticipation. That's why people are actually moving physically. The kundalini is rising for some kind of encounter. So at Mecca, you don't race right in and touch the Kaaba. You know Carrie Fisher's line down in Hollywood? She says, immediate gratification in Hollywood just ain't fast enough. So in pilgrimage, there is always this sense where you pause, you wait for a whole evening before some encounter. In this tradition, you cut your hair, you change your clothes, you take a bath, you pray, you try to get rid of demonic thoughts, and then you circumambulate seven times. It's like winding the watch before you actually are allowed to go and touch the Kaaba. I'll tell you that story later. A Pilgrim's Inn, there's an amazing detail in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales where he's at the owner of the Tabard Inn is asked for advice. You've seen pilgrims come and go. Can you give me some advice? One of the characters asks. And he says, yes. When you stop at the Pilgrim's Inns along the road, find two strangers to tell your story to. On the way to the site and on your way back after you've had an encounter, find two more strangers to tell your story to. I've been practicing that for years, and I find it has a phenomenal effect on me and other travelers. So this is an image of Kairos. I just took in the Athens Archaeology Museum. And he's the god of sacred time. If you have a problem with time, and many modern people do, right? Who's got enough time? I feel the only answer to the so-called problem with time is cultivating sacred time. Kronos is the god of ordinary time. Kairos is the god of sacred time. So here's a question for you. Are you cultivating sacred time? When you travel, do you do something to cultivate alone time, solitude, contemplation? Or are you racing? This is Glen Dulac in Ireland, a gorgeous site with a brilliant and psychologically astute practice. When you've made the long walk to Glen Dulac, on arrival, just before you reach the chapel, you are supposed to put down your backpack, put down your staff, turn around, and ask forgiveness of anybody else in the group that you've had negative thoughts about. I found this practice in Poland, in Peru, in Russia. I don't know where it came from, but I find it enormously wise that if you're feeling jealous, maybe lustful, angry, nothing will happen at the site. So it's a kind of a purification rite. If you practice a number of these things, and this is, of course, a cross-cultural comparative view of pilgrimage, then something might happen in your heart, in your soul, as exhibited here. This is Krishna on the back of the Garuda. And what it symbolizes is the hero slash traveler pilgrim whose spirit is being lifted. That's the symbolism behind the angel or the Garuda here. That when you come to the sanctuary, the cathedral, the sacred site, something is stirred, something is lifted. It's called inspiration. This is why we go to Chartres over and over again. It's why we go to certain museums to see that Vermeer or the Michelangelo, because there are places where the light pours through the darkness. I think this is part of the gorgeous symmetry of pilgrimage everywhere. The light finally pours through. You're able to divine a little bit of your future. And my recommendation is that you chronicle it. You write about it, you draw it, you compose a poem or a song, you put together a little pastiche of beer coasters and matchboxes, it doesn't matter. But if you don't chronicle it, it will disappear like the morning dew. This is Santorini. And as you're coming back, the big question, I just got this from a woman who walked from Paris to Santiago. Help! She's saying, I'm home. I don't want to be home. What do I do? What is the gift? This is what I would ask you to think about on the last day of your journey, on the way home. What is the great gift that you got out of this journey? If you're not thinking about it in terms of a gift, it wasn't a pilgrimage. I learned that in Bali a number of years ago, where I talked to these women taking fruit and vegetables and flowers to the Hindu temple and saying, any day without acknowledging the sacred in the world is a wasted day, something like that. So that we have to present gifts in honor of the sacred. In the Huichol tradition, you create a soul map of your journey. In the Islamic tradition, you can hire a painter to actually paint a mural on the wall of your house that chronicles your journey. How have you chronicled the great journeys of your life? Or is it all in photos in a shoebox under your bed? Do you tell stories? Have you made some scrapbook out of it? Have you written a song? In closing, I'll tell you, this is a rooftop view from my house in San Francisco, and I've made it a ritual to go up on the roof. Upon arriving from all my travels around the world, I go up generally with a little bottle of Glenlivet, because that's what I used to drink with Joe Campbell, and I lift my glass in a ritual that I found in Ireland a number of years ago, where a poet found a man standing on the cliffs of the Aran Islands, looking down 300 feet to the ocean, and the man bowed three times and took his hat off each time. So the visitor, the stranger, said, "Kind sir, what are you doing up here in the blustery wind? It's so dangerous to stand on the edge of the cliff. What are you doing?" And the man says, "Well, I believe I live in the most beautiful place in the world. I've never been anywhere else, but this has got to be the most beautiful place in the world. So I come up here every morning and doff my hat to the beauty of the world." And that line and that gesture, that sensibility has stayed with me all my life, and I try to enact it on my own and now with my son and my wife. And I hope this helps you a little bit. Thank you very much.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.